It's the Bert Cohen Show. America, what a history we have had. It's just been amazing. And there's a new, brand new movie out just in time for the holidays. And it's a huge, huge hit. It's a very, very good movie, I have to say. It's just called Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. And I'm pleased to say it's not fawning all over him. It certainly does not treat him as a saint, as so many other movies have done. We are here to talk about the real Abraham Lincoln, what he was, how the effects of his administration are still being felt on this country, these nations that we currently call the United States of America. I'm very pleased to have with us on the Bert Cohen Show Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, author of a book called The Real Lincoln. Thank you for being with us.
I'm pleased to be with you, Bert.
Professor DiLorenzo is professor of economics in the Selinger School of Business and Management at Loyola University in Maryland and a member of the senior faculty of the Mises, I guess it is, Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Dr. DiLorenzo's major research and publication interests are economic history, industrial organization, and political economy. He's the author or co-author of 14 books, including The Real Lincoln. He's widely published in more popular publications such as The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Barron's, and dozens of other newspapers and magazines. He's appeared on CNN, Fox News Channel, Fox Business Network, MSNBC, C-SPAN Book TV, and has been a guest on the Rush Limbaugh Show, as well as many other talk radio shows. Again, thanks for being with us. And as I said, this movie, just called Lincoln by Steven Spielberg, great acting, and the main character remains mysterious. He's still more puzzling and more interesting even after that movie. The film, I have to say, showed President Lincoln's disregard for the law, his eagerness in claiming tremendous, questionably legal power, and his belief that his power came from God, which is always kind of dangerous. Professor DiLorenzo, you've written about the real Lincoln. What was the presidency itself before Lincoln, and how did he change it, perhaps forever?
Well, generations of historians have written about what they call the Lincoln dictatorship. And so they have long called him a dictator because he suspended the writ of habeas corpus and had the army mass arrest tens of thousands of northern civilians, including the mayor of Baltimore, a congressman from Baltimore, about half of the Maryland state legislature, newspaper editors. He shut down over 300 opposition newspapers. And so, yeah, he was very dictatorial and pretty much trashed the Constitution in many ways. He deported the leading spokesman for the Democrats of his day, Congressman Clement Vallandigham of Ohio, had him deported. Yeah, he was a dictator. The generations of historians call him a dictator, but they say he was a good dictator because he saved the Union. So the ends justify the means is the argument that is always made about Lincoln. I doubt, by the way, that he thought God gave him these powers and not the Constitution, because Lincoln, according to his own wife, was never a believer. Never joined a church, rarely stepped foot in the church, and I think he was an atheist myself. There's no evidence he ever was a believer in God.
Well, interesting. I knew there had to be some inaccuracies in the movie.
there is a big one. I mean, the whole movie is based on a fiction. The fiction is that Abraham Lincoln used his political skills to get the 13th Amendment that ended slavery passed through the House of Representatives. But, you know, the preeminent Lincoln scholar of our day is Harvard University's David Donald in his biography of Lincoln, his Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, on page 544.
Oh, big
book. He proves that Lincoln, that this myth, that Lincoln did talk to one or two members of Congress about the 13th Amendment, but then he says there's no evidence that, even one person changed his vote as a result of anything Lincoln did. On the 13th Amendment. And so the whole story of the movie is really based on a falsehood.
I am amazed at that they could be so bold and brash as to make something up out of whole cloth, it seems.
Well, they did, and I have an article about it coming out tomorrow on lewrockwell.com, the website, that quotes David Donald in the whole chapter and verse showing that. And, you know, the movie is based on several chapters of a book by Doris Kearns
yes.
Goodwin called Team of Rivals.
Right.
And she confessed to having plagiarized dozens of pages of another author several years ago. And she was kicked off the Pulitzer Prize Committee. She was kicked off PBS for a while. But, you know, being a part of the establishment, she quickly made a comeback and wrote a book on Lincoln. And so she's not exactly the most reliable source of historical accuracy. I would choose David Donald of Harvard over her any day.
Well, I wonder about getting the amendment passed, which was the official change in the U.S. Constitution, allegedly banning slavery forever, and we'll have to talk about that because it didn't really. The votes that there were no, obviously, Confederate states involved in the passage of that. Was it so difficult for President Lincoln to get it passed?
No, it wasn't. And he didn't get it passed. It wasn't him that got it passed. It was the real abolitionists in Congress, people like Thaddeus Stevens.
Uh-huh.
Lincoln was never an abolitionist, though, in his famous Cooper Union speech when he went to New York before he was elected. He said, we have abolitionists in Illinois. We shot one the other day, and that supposedly brought big laughter among the audience. And so he never was an abolitionist. He distanced himself from the abolitionists,
yes.
who he thought were dangerous and would cause a disruption of the Union. But it was the real abolitionists in the Congress who got it passed. And as David Donald shows in his book on Lincoln, Lincoln did almost nothing. For example, he was told that he could help win some votes of Democrats from New Jersey if he were to get Senator Charles Sumner to withdraw a law that he had proposed that would regulate a railroad in New Jersey. And Lincoln refused to help. He refused to do it. He did nothing. And so it's actually documented that he had a chance to actually assist the abolitionists in the U.S. House of Representatives to get the 13th Amendment passed, and he said no thanks. He declined. Just the opposite of the story that is told in Spielberg's movie.
Wow. Amazing. You're listening to the Burt Cohen Show. We're talking about the new movie, Lincoln, which is a big hit. Movies tend to be fiction, and they're there for entertainment, and as such, this one works. You mentioned about railroads, and I think it's a very interesting thing to look at the power of Abraham Lincoln, specifically when it comes to concentrating and centralizing power. And if we look at the corporatization of America that we have been living under for quite some time, Lincoln got his start as a successful railroad lawyer. They were, at the time, the most powerful corporate political entity of the whole rest of the 19th century. Railroad expansion was a major part of his vision for America. He was dedicated to the federal government directly aiding the construction of railroads from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and he felt that without federal help, there would not be the economic development that the country wanted. Now, wasn't this a good thing to have railroads change the whole frame of understanding of what time was? Because people, you know, the railroads ran on time. Before the railroads, there were actually different, ways of looking at time. There was different time zones all over the country, and it connected the country. And what else did the power of the railroads do to America that Lincoln was so much in favor of?
Well, Lincoln wasn't in favor of railroads per se. He was in favor of what today we call corporate welfare for the railroads. You know, the British used private capital to build their railroad system several decades before the Americans did. And there's a man named James J. Hill, who was a Canadian who migrated to Minnesota in the 19th century, who built a privately funded transcontinental railroad called the Great Northern without a penny of government aid. And it was the most efficient and most successful transcontinental railroad of the 19th century. So he proved that you didn't need corporate welfare to have transcontinental railroad.
Mm.
But Lincoln was a Whig for much longer than he was a Republican.
Yes.
And the Whig Party of the 19th century stood for basically a system of government policy that would benefit corporations at the expense of everybody else. They were for protectionist tariffs. They were for using tax dollars to subsidize road building and railroad corporations. And they were for a national bank run by politicians, but at least partly privately owned, that would finance all this corporate welfare. And it was the Jeffersonians who opposed them all throughout the 19th century. But Lincoln's victory pretty much put an end to that great debate between the Jeffersonians, who favored more free market economics, free enterprise, and limited and decentralized government.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hamiltonians finally won that debate. Lincoln was a Hamiltonian politically.
Yes.
He was for a big centralized government and a government that ran primarily for the benefit of corporations, which is always at the expense of the consumer.
Yeah, and interesting how today, you know, fast forward 150 years or so, and you see too big to fail. The people's taxes had to bail out the huge financial interest that dug us into the hole in the first place. And it seems to me, perhaps you see things differently, that Lincoln kind of set the stage and planted the seed that made things like that happen, the power of the big financial interests over the people. As you said, the difference between Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian democracy. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think it is. You know, he didn't really believe in government of the people, by the people, for the people. He believed in government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations, and the politicians. That's what he did in reality. For example,
in
1861, the war is about to commence. You know, Fort Sumter has already happened. Lincoln called a special session of Congress to get the ball rolling on the Pacific Railway Act, which would massively subsidize railroad corporations. And it took him about a year. And then when he finally signed the bill gave the president, him, the right to decide the eastern terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad that would be subsidized by the taxpayers. And he chose Council Bluffs, Iowa, where he personally had invested in several hundred acres of real estate in 1857. So he must have made a killing in real estate on that particular type of insider trading. And many of the leading lights of the Republican Party, from Thaddeus Stevens all down,
mm-hmm.
became very, very wealthy as a result of the Pacific Railway Bill. Stevens was a steel manufacturer. There was a man named Oakes Ames from New England who manufactured shovels, and the government bought many hundreds of thousands of shovels from him to build the railroads. And so it created a dynasty of wealthy families that were linked to the Republican Party. When they passed the Pacific Railway Act.
Fascinating. Yeah, we see the seeds of it now. And again, at least this movie does not fawn all over President Lincoln and make him a saint, which he seemed to have become when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s. And so many of the issues that the anger that there is today, that the corporations have so much power and control, and the voice of the people is so limited. It's created anger from both the left and the right. And I thought it was fascinating. On November 23rd, Charles Blow, a columnist for the New York Times, wrote about where we are now. And I think this is very interesting, and it'll certainly make the listener, and I'm sure Professor DiLorenzo, think about President Lincoln. Charles Blow talked about a growing gap in the United States, which he said, quote, has geographic contours, the densely populated coastal states versus the less densely populated states of the Rocky Mountains, Mississippi Delta, and the Great Plains. He said it threatens the very concept of a United States. It is becoming ever more clear that red states are becoming more ideologically strident and creating a regional quasi-country within the greater one. We are moving toward two Americas with two contrasting and increasingly codified concepts of liberty. And he ends his article asking, can such a nation long endure?
Well, I think that's been true for a long, long time.
Yes.
Thomas Jefferson himself thought that the United States would probably be broken up into 3, 4, 5, or 6 different confederacies, and he thought it would be a good thing. He said in letters that he wrote before his death that they would all be Americans, and I would wish them all well, and I would do whatever I could to encourage them, because the Founding Fathers never thought that the type of democracy they were creating, whether you call it a constitutional republic or whatever, could exist with 300 million people. Even at the time of Jefferson, he thought the country was already too big to be governed by one unitary government. And so this has been going on for a long, long time, and I think it would be a good thing if someday we did have maybe 10 separate republics or 12 separate republics who would all be Americans, and maybe at least one would be devoted to liberty and freedom as opposed to welfare statism and endless warfare around the world and being the world's policeman.
Yeah,
you would see that all as a good thing.
I happen to agree, you know, and I just think that it was fascinating. Toward the end of the movie, there was somebody who was saying something about, you know, what kind of a democracy is this when it was forced together by cannon fire? It was created to do. I mean, what kind of a democracy is that? We're talking with Professor Thomas DiLorenzo, author of The Real Lincoln, about the movie and about reality. And, you know, his impact is still being felt. Could it be argued that in the war against the South, we really cannot call it a civil war, because a civil war is a fight between two sides for power over one government? That is not what this was. There are plenty of legitimate civil wars. This is not a civil war. But could it be argued that the North was trying to deny the Southerners their inherent right to be governed by their consent, that the North intended to violently force the obedience of the Southern states to a union they did not wish to enter? And it's,
well, sure.
And it does seem to me that if that was true, which it seems to be, guess what? There's going to be a little bit of resentment for many, many years afterwards.
Yes, well, you know, the great H.L. Mencken, the journalist, the mid-20th century journalist, wrote an article once about the Gettysburg Address, and he said, well, it's fine poetry, but it's untrue. It was the South that no longer consented to be governed by Washington, D.C.,
right,
and it was the U.S. Army that was fighting to deny government by consent among the Southerners. And the original union was a voluntary union. So in my writings, I've written numerous times, pointing out the obvious fact that Lincoln's war destroyed the union of the Founding Fathers.
Mm.
It was a voluntary union. Article 7 of the U.S. Constitution says that the Constitution will be ratified by the states. The states were sovereign. But it was held together at gunpoint. And by the way, their latest estimates of the death toll, their revised estimates of the death toll of the Civil War, and for 100 and some years, historians said it was about 620,000 dead Americans, but it's as many as 850, according to the latest research, which has become pretty much accepted by the history profession. There's a demographic historian named David Hackett who has published on this, and anybody can look him up online. And James McPherson and all the other big shots in the history, Civil War history profession, have accepted his numbers now. And that was at a time when the population of the United States was about one-tenth of what it is today.
Right.
So it would be the equivalent of as many as 8.5 million Americans dying in 4 years in the war. And so that's what kept the Union together. So when you watch the movie and you hear lines like, he made us all one, or he kept us all together, well, he didn't really do that. He destroyed the voluntary Union of the states by invading the Southern states.
And it was an incredibly, just unbelievably brutal war. They didn't even have ways to identify bodies. And it's just, you know, the more... Go ahead.
I'm in Maryland here, and in Frederick, Maryland, there's a Civil War Medicine Museum, and a group of doctors put together and donated some money, and they have all the medical tools that were used at the time. If you walk through there, it looks like a carpenter's shop with a bunch of saws, They use 52 caliber rounds in the muskets, and if you get hit with one of those, it just blows you apart. And so we now know there are as many as 850,000 deaths, even if that's an exaggeration, and it's, quote, only 750,000. It's still mind-boggling, and there were more than double that amount maimed for life in the war. And so, and even the old number, the 620,000 number, is more Americans than died in all other American wars combined. All of the wars, World War One, World War Two, Vietnam, Korea, and so forth, don't amount to 620,000, let alone 850,000.
We are talking again with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, author of The Real Lincoln, looking at the movie. Now, you know, when I was growing up in the 50s, it was very simple to say, and history in America tends to be real simple, and myth generally takes precedence over reality. You know, we were taught the old phrase, Lincoln freed the slaves. Right, Lincoln freed the slaves. It's now pretty much by virtually all historians, I believe, universally understood that the original purpose of the war was never to free the slaves. And I've read quite a few books about the war. I highly recommend America Aflame by David Goldfield. Very, very interesting book. And it seems to me, and I'd love to get your take on this, that the war at its essence was a battle between two visions. One, consolidated empire favored, as you say, by the Whigs and Federalists, the Hamiltonians. The other vision of a confederacy of sovereign and equal states as envisioned by Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. Is that really what the war was about and not slavery?
I think that's exactly right. It's the compact theory of the states versus the unitary centralization theory of the state. If you read the Declaration of Independence, the last couple of paragraphs, it refers to the states as the free and independent states, and it says free and independent to do what? Well, to raise taxes and to wage war if necessary. So the founders saw each state as a state in the same sense that France or England were states, and it was a confederacy of sovereign states. And so the rights of secession and nullification were an integral part of American federalism. And American federalism, of course, is a defining characteristic, the unique characteristic of the original American system. But those were both destroyed by Lincoln's War, where Americans were taught that if you try to pretend that you're withdrawing your consent to be governed by Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. will invade and conquer you and murder your citizens by the thousands.
Yeah.
And by the way, the definition of treason in the United States Constitution is in Article 3, Section 3, and I encourage anyone listening to go and read it online. It says, treason shall be defined only, it uses the word only, as levying war upon the United States or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. It uses the word their in the plural, which meant the free and independent states. So levying war upon any one of the free and independent states is the definition of treason under the United States Constitution.
Wow.
And that, of course, is exactly what Lincoln did when he waged war on the southern states. And so the war was an act of treason on the part of the U.S. government.
And we could talk about the Civil War for days and days and days, the so-called Civil War. I have to say that, you know, Fort Sumter, it seems to me, was obviously the excuse that the president was looking for to start the war. Every war has to have that. And I think recognizes that, look, slavery had to end. Slavery is incredibly evil. It's a horrible thing. It had to be ended. Now, I find it very interesting that Bob Dylan, Confederate, in September of this year, 2012, said, quote, if slavery had been given up in a more peaceful way, America would be far ahead today. This is Bob Dylan talking now. Can you convince listeners that the profound evil of slavery would have ended without the war against the South? Would slavery have ended? And how can you specify that yes, in fact, it would have ended without the war in the South?
Well, I would recommend that they read a book called Greatest Emancipations by Jim Powell. It talks about how all other countries of the world, the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French, the Danes, the Dutch, the Swedes, the state of Maine, the state of New York, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, they all ended slavery peacefully without a war. The only place in the world in the 19th century where slavery was ended, where a war was involved, was during Lincoln's War. And I have an article on LouRockwell.com last week entitled Lincoln's Greatest Failure. And it talks about this, about how if he was such a clever politician, which is the theme of the Spielberg movie, then what he would have done, if his real objective was to end slavery, was he would have used his political skills to do what the British did, and find a way to peacefully purchase the freedom of the slaves and then end slavery legislatively. That's how everyone else did it. There were slaves in New York City until 1853. After all, there's a book called Slavery in New York. The New York Historical Society had a big exhibit several years ago on slavery in New York, and the book, you know, explains how they went about it peacefully. And so a real statesman would have done that, would have taken the roadmap provided him by the Europeans and by the northern states. There were no wars of emancipation in Connecticut or New York or anywhere like that. They found a way to peacefully put an end to the evil institution of slavery. But most Americans don't know anything about this, and so they think, they sort of assume that slavery ended everywhere with some sort of big war that killed hundreds of thousands of people. And you're right with your earlier comment. Neither Lincoln nor the Congress ever said that the cause of the war had anything to do with ending slavery. It was always forcing the Southerners to remain in the Union and pay taxes.
Now, economically, I wonder, the South, my understanding was it was cotton was king and slavery was absolutely essential to the economy. Mike, I have a sense also that the world economy was changing at the time and that cotton was becoming less and less profitable, and that just by pure economics alone, the world was industrializing, that slavery became, frankly, less profitable and probably would have faded out all by itself. But what do you know about such things, Professor?
Well, the government subsidized slavery with the Fugitive Slave Act, which Lincoln was a very strong supporter of. It forced Northerners to hunt down runaway slaves and return them to their owners. So just getting rid of that would have been an economic death blow to slavery. It would have greatly increased the cost and reduced the profitability of being in the slave business. And the economics of it, too, is you have to understand that slave labor is always less efficient than free labor. You know, you have no incentive at all to improve your skill, to work hard, and so forth when you're a slave, because you see no benefit in it for you personally. But with free labor, you can see, you know, making your way up the economic ladder if you improve your skills and have a good work record. Everybody knows that. And so slavery was actually a hindrance to the Southern economy and to the whole U.S. economy from that perspective. And also, you know, the average Confederate soldier was a yeoman farmer who did not own slaves.
Right.
And slavery was a detriment to him because he had to compete with the large plantations that did have slave labor, you know, as a small farmer. And so the average Confederate infantry soldier would have been a natural political constituency for getting rid of slavery, because it deprived him not only of that, but of jobs. If he wasn't a farmer and he was a farm laborer, well, he had to compete for jobs with slaves, and so there would have been more farm labor jobs for the average, you know, infantryman in the Confederate Army. But that's one of the things that sort of been swept under the rug by the history profession over the years.
And certainly, you know, we can easily recognize racism today. We know what it is. But actually, in the 1800s, the word racism, the concept of racism, didn't even exist. Was there a clear north-south distinction? You know, was it divided north and south on what we'd now call racism?
There was. According to Tocqueville, in his famous book, Democracy in America, he pointed out the irony that what he called the problem of race was worse in the north than it was in the south, even though there were more slaves in the south during his time. And, in the 1820s and 1830s, when he was in America, there were still slaves in New York and Pennsylvania and a lot of the northern states, not nearly as many as there were in the South. But he believed that racism was actually worse. You know, he didn't use the word racism, but he did say the problem of race was worse in the North than the South. And it was pretty much, you know, it was existent everywhere. And Lincoln was a man of his time. He was as much a white supremacist as anyone. In his first Lincoln-Douglas debate, he said, "I, as much as any man, am in favor of the superior position being given to the white race." And in the same speech, he denied, he said that, "I'm against making voters or jurors of Negroes or allowing them to intermarry with white people." And so, that's just about all white people were white supremacists in the mid-19th century.
Absolutely. We are talking with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, author of a book called The Real Lincoln. And we were talking about racism and in the North. There was quite a bit there as well. What were some of the real reasons why the Northerners opposed the expansion of slavery into the Western territories? My understanding, and I read this relatively recently, they wanted the West all to white people, and that was part of it. What do you know about that?
Yeah, well, Lincoln himself, in one of his speeches, he said, "We want the territories for free white labor." And so the Northerners were at least as much racist as Southerners were, and New Englanders had been spreading out and been settling some of the territories, and being racist as they were, they did not want black people, free or slave, living among them. That's why states like Illinois, land of Lincoln, amended its constitution in 1848 to make it illegal for black people to reside there, and Abraham Lincoln supported that as a politician in the Illinois state legislature. And so so that was one reason. Another reason is they didn't want competition for jobs, either by free blacks or slaves. And so when the Republican Party in 1860 wrote its platform, it did not oppose Southern slavery. In fact, it defended to the hilt Southern slavery, as Lincoln did in his first inaugural address. He even pledged his support of a constitutional amendment in his first inaugural that was known as the Corwin Amendment, named after a Republican Congressman Thomas Corwin of Pennsylvania, that would have prohibited the federal government from ever interfering in Southern slavery. But the reasons they gave for opposing the extension of slavery were one, protectionism. They wanted to pander to the white male voters and say, "We will protect your jobs from free blacks or slaves, and black people in general." And also, there was the Three-Fifths Clause of the Constitution that existed at the time that said that every five slaves counts as three persons in the census for purposes of determining how many members of Congress each state will have. And so if slaves were brought into the territories, it would have increased the representation of the Democratic Party, they thought. Therefore, they opposed the extension of slavery into the territories. So it was not a moral argument. It was not anything like that. It was based purely on politics and economics.
Yeah, it's funny how those things happen. Economics, money calls the shots. And, I have read that this movie certainly is about Lincoln's heavy, heavy lifting, fictional apparently, about getting the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, not just the Emancipation Proclamation, but it written into the Constitution. His Emancipation Proclamation happened earlier, and of course, as everybody knows, it didn't affect anything because it only applied in areas where the Union government was not recognized and had no power. And tell us about how the Emancipation Proclamation itself was a military, purely a military tactic. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, Lincoln called it a war measure, which meant that if the South surrendered or if they negotiated a peace the next day, it would have become defunct and the Southerners could have done whatever they wanted to do with slaves, for one thing. And it specifically exempted all the parishes in Louisiana where the Union Army was in control at the time. It specifically exempted West Virginia because the Lincoln administration had orchestrated the illegal secession of West Virginia into the Union. West Virginia was the last slave state to enter the Union, and it was all a part of the Union during the Lincoln administration, slaves and all. And so his position was always, you can keep your slaves as long as you stay in the Union and pay federal taxes. And so so that's what was going on with the Emancipation Proclamation. It was probably intended to send a message to the European powers that don't consider assisting the Confederate government because we're announcing that slavery is now an issue of the war. And some people, historians for many generations, have thought that it was probably also intended to incite slave rebellions in the South, which it didn't. The slaves knew about it. I visited the Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois, a couple of years ago, and there was a video presentation where they had the face of a former slave, and a voiceover, and the voice was saying his words, the slave, the ex-slave's words, and his words were mocking and ridiculing Lincoln for the Emancipation Proclamation, because this man who had been taught to read and was a smart guy, he was a slave, and he knew that this Emancipation Proclamation had been issued, and it didn't have any effect on him. He was still a slave, and so after the war was over, they had his words recorded as saying, this was nonsense. I wasn't freed by any proclamation in 1863. I was still a slave in 1864, he was saying. And so this was widely known at the time, but it really had no effect on freeing anybody.
In what way was it a military tactic?
Well, I think a military tactic, meaning Lincoln was worried that the British or the French might have assisted in some way the Confederates. And so just by breaching the whole topic of slavery, I think he assumed that the British would not do anything to assist the Confederates. And also, I think a lot of people have said, like I said, that if there were slave rebellions in the South, then a lot of the soldiers would probably have left the army and gone home to defend their families from the rebellions. And so that's the sense in which it was a military tactic, or at least intended to be a military tactic, but it didn't really work out that way.
Hmm. Again, if you just tuned in, this is the Bert Cohen Show. Our guest today is Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, author of The Real Lincoln, and we are looking at the movie. And one of the stories within the movie was this contingent of peace negotiators, high-level Confederate government representatives who were headed to Washington to talk peace, and Lincoln basically, according to the movie anyway, held them hostage and didn't allow them to come to Washington. Could there have been a negotiated peace with them? Is that story true? And B, why didn't he negotiate with them?
Well, the same thing happened before the war. Right at the outset of the war, the Confederates sent peace commissioners, who Lincoln refused to talk to them. And Napoleon III of France also offered to try to arbitrate between the two sides, and Lincoln refused to see him also. He wanted a war. And why did he want a war? Well, of course, in 1861, it had nothing whatsoever to do with slavery. He wanted a war to destroy once and for all this idea of state sovereignty. If you're sovereign, if the citizens of a state are sovereign, then they have a right to join or not to join the Union. And he wanted to destroy that, and so he absolutely refused to talk to anybody from the South to negotiate anything at the outset of the war. And I assume for the same reason at the end of the war, in 1865, the Southerners, they weren't about to say, okay, we'll come back into the Union and continue to pay federal taxes. They're not going to do that after all they went through for 4 years after being bombed out and hundreds of thousands of their people being killed by the U.S. Army. And so he didn't meet with them.
Pretty amazing. And I read a book about Antietam recently, the battle there where Lincoln was furious at General McClellan for not obliterating General Lee's forces. And, of course, McClellan was replaced. And then eventually General Sherman came, and there was initiated a war of total destruction, total war, wherein civilians became legitimate targets. And at that moment, as well as others, could there not have been, after Antietam, could there not have been a peace, saving perhaps tens of thousands of lives and limbs? Why he just couldn't live with a two-state solution?
No, obviously not. McClellan wrote a letter to Lincoln in 1862 when he was still in command, expressing his concern, and he was really bothered by the fact that a lot of parts of the army had been pillaging and plundering the civilians in Virginia and elsewhere, and Lincoln replaced him shortly after that. And he apparently didn't want to hear anything about that. And so, yeah, it was a war of terrorism against Southern civilians. Even according to James McPherson, who is a very pro-Lincoln Civil War historian, in one of his books, Battle Cry of Freedom, he claims that at least 50,000 Southern civilians were killed in the war. which would, like I said, compared to today's population, would be like the equivalent of 500,000 today, with today's population being much bigger.
Right.
And so, he thought it was worth it, I guess. You know, he might have paraphrased Madeleine Albright's famous comment about dead children in Iraq when she said, "It's a price we are willing to pay." Well, it obviously was a price Lincoln was willing to pay, as hundreds of thousands of dead Americans, to create a centralized, consolidated state in Washington, D.C.
And I have been amazed, the more I have learned about the so-called Civil War and President Lincoln, how there were many, many opportunities for peace, and that the bloodshed that followed, it seems to me like tens of thousands of lives could have easily been saved. But Lincoln, even in the movie, had a real sense of tremendous power. He talked about enjoying this tremendous power. It just, there's something really bizarre about that. That, you know, people who are in love with their own power, yikes! That's not good for anything like a republic or a democracy. And one thing I thought was fascinating, and I don't know how true this is, that toward the end of the movie, Lincoln says he wants to bring the Southerners back as full citizens and not have them feel that they were the vanquished or the conquered. But isn't that exactly what happened? Was the part of the movie wrong? Was it that, you know, okay, Lincoln was killed, he wanted them to come back as full citizens, but that's not how they were treated by President Johnson and then President Grant?
Yeah, there's no reason to believe that's true. When he was still alive, Lincoln proposed that the Republican Party take over the southern states after the war, and he said if they could round up 10% of the voters to vote for them, that they could use that to legitimize the sort of military rule of the southern states. So he proposed a 10% minority democracy to be run essentially by the Republican Party. And, you know, that makes a farce out of the whole idea of democracy. But that's what his actual proposal was, as opposed to what Steven Spielberg portrays him as saying in his movie. And so that's another falsehood of the movie, that he was sort of wanted to bring them back in. You know, the Southerners were kicked out of the Union after the war because they were told you can't come into the Union and have congressional representation until you vote in favor of the 14th Amendment. And so in Ohio and Oregon protested that after the war. They rescinded their ratification of the 14th Amendment in a protest of the way that this was done, that it was done illegally and unconstitutionally. And so the 14th Amendment was never actually really properly ratified. The Senate just declared that it was ratified, even though they didn't have three-fourths of the states after Ohio and Oregon dropped out.
Wow, amazing. And one thing that there's more and more concern about now with the new 21st century technology, government spying and government clamping down on our traditional civil liberties. There's a lot more capability to do that now. We have the so-called Patriot Act, which I think is rather unpatriotic myself, and being able to spy on American citizens. Lincoln, this didn't come up at all in the war, his clampdown on newspapers and civil liberties. What do we know about that? I mean, was this like something really new at the time that, habeas corpus?
Yeah, well, there had been, you know, the Federalist under President John Adams had the Sedition Act that made free speech illegal in America. They actually jailed people for criticizing the Adams administration, so there had been a precedent for that. But Lincoln was many orders of magnitude worse. The book on the topic was written by James Randall, who was the last generation's preeminent Lincoln scholar. He taught at the University of Illinois for many years. And the book is called Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln. And he documents how the Republican Party under Lincoln shut down more than 300 opposition newspapers and imprisoned without habeas corpus, without due process, many dozens of newspaper editors and owners who were merely criticizing the Lincoln administration. I'm sitting here in Baltimore right now, and the grandson of Francis Scott Key, the author of The Star-Spangled Banner, was a newspaper editor. Frank Howard Key is his name, And he was in prison without due process. He wasn't charged with anything because he had written an editorial criticizing Lincoln's illegal suspension of habeas corpus. And so he was thrown in a dungeon in Fort McHenry, of all places, not too far from where his grandfather composed the Star-Spangled Banner during the War of 1812.
Amazing. History is fascinating. It ain't what we've been taught as kids, for sure. And, you know, the legacy of racism. And I got to tell you, when I was growing up in the 1950s, I saw, you know, the police and the dogs and the fire hoses. I thought it was an aberration confined to the South. That's how it was being presented to me. I have since learned it wasn't an aberration at all. But what we recognize as racism today was just, you know, that was part of America. Even, you know, great liberal leaders like William Jennings Bryan. Oh, yeah, just whites were superior. That, you know, that was all over the country for the most part. And I have to wonder about, you know, we were taught Lincoln freed the slaves, that, okay, the reality, I wonder on racial violence, for example, after an unbelievably devastating war in the South, which there was hardly anything in the North. All the devastation, tremendous devastation, was in the South. The North invaded the South. That's where the destruction was. After that came this Reconstruction, which turned the South into an occupied country. And there was, you know, of course, seething rage at the Northerners and the former slaves who were put into positions of power. After Reconstruction came something called the Redemption Movement, after the North left and the abolitionists turned their attention elsewhere. They were tired of that issue. They didn't care anymore, you know, once the slavery had been ended. So how did the so-called Civil War affect racial violence, do you think, Professor DiLorenzo?
Well, it's one of the points I make in my book, The Real Lincoln, is I quote one of Lincoln's generals, a General Don Piatt, P-I-A-T-T is how he spelled his name. He was a general in Lincoln's army, and he became a newspaper editor in Washington, D.C. after the war, and he claims that this whole business of Reconstruction, for a while, the white male population of the South was disenfranchised, where the Republican Party registered to vote all the adult male ex-slaves that they could, and some of them they put in as sort of puppet politicians in state legislatures to vote for tax increase and debt after debt to supposedly build railroads and things like that, and but very little got reconstructed after the war. And then 10 years later, you know, this lasted for about 10 years, all of a sudden the U.S. Army leaves. So you have a minority population, the black population of the South, that had been in cahoots with the hated Republican Party for 10 years to essentially plunder white Southerners, and then they're left defenseless as a tiny minority among the population. And that led to all the violence and the Ku Klux Klan and the Jim Crow laws and all that. And I make the case in my book that this probably would never have happened had we not ended slavery the way we did. Had we ended it peacefully the way everyone else on the planet did in the 19th century, there never would have been a Ku Klux Klan. It was started to intimidate black voters after the Civil War, you know, to terrorize and intimidate them from becoming participants in the Republican Party plundering of the South. For example, in South Carolina, which was totally devastated by Sherman's army, by 1870, property taxes were 30 times higher than they were in 1860. So what they needed was tax amnesty to help them get back on their feet economically, but they were just interested in plundering. They weren't interested in having a thriving Southern economy with free labor. The Republican Party wasn't. And President Johnson, by the way, he sent a man down south after the war because they had taxes on cotton. They put a special tax on cotton, but there was almost no money from it ending up in the Treasury. And President Andrew Johnson was saying, well, where's all the money? We have a special tax on cotton. What was happening is Republican Party hacks would go down, and they would approach farmers and say, pay me X dollars, and I will forget about this special tax on cotton. Or if you can't pay the tax, I'm taking your cotton, which they often did, and then sold it. And so a lot of money was just stolen by Republican Party hacks who went down as so-called carpetbaggers after the war. And so no wonder Southerners resented that. And none of that would have happened had we ended slavery peacefully, in my opinion.
And again, to quote Bob Dylan, of all people, you know, certainly no, you know, Confederate, he said, quote, if slavery had been given up in a more peaceful way, America would be far ahead today. Now, granted, he is, you know, just Bob Dylan, but, you know, and I wonder, you know, Yankees of the 18th and 19th centuries feared what would happen to America if the Southern aristocracy ever took over. And a lot of Northern liberals today, there have been a lot of articles written about the seeming dominance of the old Southern aristocratic values over the whole country, such as, you know, things like the power of wealthy white men, the health care debate, the power of unions, things like this. There's been articles written about, you know, basically 21st century plantation owners have all the power. So in terms of, you know, of self-government, had Lincoln made peace, not insisted on actual capitulation and surrender, might each nation, at least the two nations, the South and the North, have been free to follow its own cultural norms without having to fight each other's competing sets of values? There are, you know, with exceptions, obviously, two different sets of values. There's Yankee values and Southern values. They are different powers. I mean, different values right now. You know, why couldn't the North just recognize the irresolvable differences and just let the South go?
Yeah, well, I would recommend an article you can find on the web by Clyde Wilson called The Yankee Problem in America. You can just Google it. You'll probably find it. And he writes about how you know, not all Northerners were Yankees. The Yankee was a particular type of person who believed that he was God's chosen person on earth, and he was superior to all others, and therefore he had the right and the duty to force other people to be like him. And Clyde Wilson calls Hillary Clinton a museum-quality specimen of a Yankee. She's from Connecticut and Illinois, and there was a Yankee belt. It went through New England, across northern Pennsylvania and Ohio, and the upper Midwest. That was the Yankee belt in the mid-19th century, and it was these types of people who we still see today who were largely running the government, and because they want to force everybody else to be like us. And the government claimed it has a treasury of virtue.
Yeah.
After the war, there's a famous book called The Legacy of the Civil War by Robert Penn Warren, the novelist, where he points out that after the war, the North claimed to have a treasury of virtue, and that means that no matter what sin they commit, no matter what they do, whatever they do is virtuous, as they being the government, by virtue of the fact that it's the U.S. government doing it. And he claims that that led to our participation in World War One and World War Two, and up through today. You know, we're out there bullying Libya and Egypt now because we think we have so much virtue that it is our duty to make all these people around the world virtuous like us. That's the Yankee mentality, and that's what the Southerners were trying to escape. And all, not just the Southerners. There's a book called The Secession Movement in the Middle Atlantic States, which existed by William C. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, about in the 1850s, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland. They wanted to either join a Southern Confederacy or have their own Confederacy because they did not want to be a part of a government with the New England Yankees. Everyone, you know, a lot of people at the time just hated his attitude, this imperialistic attitude that they had, and so they wanted out.
And
New York City, the mayor of New York City, Fernando Wood, wanted New York City to be a free city and secede from the state of New York and U.S.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. They are different from the rest of the state of New York, for sure. And one of the issues that still haunts us that President Lincoln kicked off was imperialism, where they had that right. I mean, it was imperialist war against the South and creating empire. You can't really have an empire and a republic. And we've had all these imperialist wars. I mean, the First World War is just, you know, a mystery to me as to why we fought in there. But you just touched on it and, you know, started to answer that a little bit. And this whole notion of imperialism and these huge expenditures of money on warfare and imperialism to benefit the big, you know, rulers, the corporate rulers of this country. It's nuts.
Yeah. You know, as soon as the Civil War was over, by July, you know, the war, Robert E. Lee surrendered in April. Right. By July, General Sherman was put in charge of the Military District of Missouri, which is all land west of the Mississippi, and his main job was to commence a campaign of genocide against the Plains Indians. And there was a 25-year war of genocide, really, against the Plains Indians, primarily to make way for the railroads, for the government-subsidized transcontinental railroads. Sherman himself said that. I quote him from his own memoirs as saying that that was the purpose of it. And according to the researchers, as many as 50,000 Indians, women and children included, were killed by the U.S. Army in the 2 decades after the Civil War ended.
Yeah, and there was that whole Dakota War as well, which, you know, another ugly thing. So if you like corporate rule over all of us, if you like imperialism, you must love President Abraham Lincoln. But a lot of people don't. And I must recommend another book, Professor DiLorenzo, which you've probably read, just called American Nations, The 11 Nations of North America by Colin Woodard. It's amazing, the description of the history of these various different nations within these currently United States. And, you know, the past isn't past. It's still here. Obviously, there's more talk than ever. There's a lot of seething, that the anger, and it's still going on. Professor DiLorenzo, thanks so much for being with us. Fascinating, fascinating interview into what Lincoln really was. The book is called The Real Lincoln. The author, as we spoke to today, Professor Thomas DiLorenzo, thanks so much for being with us today on the Burt Cohen Show.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you. And yeah, it was some tough stuff. I do recommend the movie. It's very good entertainment, probably up for an Oscar.
Virgil Caine is a name, and I served on the Danville train till Stallman's cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. What you need.